For more than two decades, award-winning science and nature writer David Quammen has traveled to Earth's most far-flung and fragile destinations, sending back field notes from places caught in the tension between humans and the wild. His new book, The Heartbeat of the Wild, features 20 of those assignments, written narratives originally published in National Geographic magazine and updated for today, telling colorful and impassioned stories from some of the planet's wildest locales. Again, the name of the book is The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. And it's a pleasure to welcome David Quammen to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Very good to be with you, Joe. I appreciate it.
Always good to have you on the show. Give us a sense of what brought you to this particular subject.
Oh, a lifetime. I was one of those nature kids who lived in the woods behind the house. And then I turned into a novelist at the beginning of my career 50 years ago. And then I drifted into nonfiction writing, magazine writing, and later nonfiction books, and circled back to that interest in the natural world. In the course of writing a column for Outside Magazine for about 15 years, I learned a lot of ecology and evolutionary biology. And then in 1999, I got a call from National Geographic to do a big project for them that involved sort of an epic walk across the Congo. And I've been doing it ever since. It was 20 years of work for them and these 21 assignments in which they sort of went to me for the wild creatures in the wild places. And it was my pleasure to write about them and then pull them together into this book.
And this idea of dispatches, because this tells the stories of where you were and when and what happened, and we can glean a lot from that as to, in a way, of chronology of how things have changed over time, over those decades.
That's right. Yes, they certainly have. And as I said, this is based on 21 articles that I did for National Geographic, although I've done a lot of further work pulling them together, updating the reporting from these different sites in Africa and elsewhere around the world, stitching them together with connective tissue that tells the story of how the assignments took shape and how one led to another, and a new forward and an afterward, giving sort of an overview of this subject, wild creatures, wild places, how precious they are and what it takes to conserve them. So I think of it not just as a collection, but as sort of a narrative manifesto on the subject of wildness on planet Earth in the 21st century.
The last word of the subtitle is hope, and there are a lot of things in this book that sort of have you questioning hope, but you are hopeful.
I am hopeful, and partly that's because I view hope not as sort of a psychological mood, but as a duty. I feel like I have a duty. I feel like we have a duty to remain hopeful, because when you give up hope, you stop fighting. And even though things are grim in some ways on this planet, we have three big problems that are caused by us humans: climate change, loss of biological diversity, and the emergence of pandemic threats. Although we have those problems, there are still always things that we can do to mitigate those problems, to slow those problems, even to reverse some of those problems. And when you spend time around people like Edward O. Wilson and Jane Goodall and Greg Carr, the fellow who engineered the restoration of Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique, you see the determined hope in them, and you feel that duty. You know, you just got to be hopeful and fight on.
In the sense of these columns, these essays that you make are part of that make up the book, they all are really interesting, fascinating places, and I'm curious as to how those assignments come about, and then how you take on the task of really bringing them to life and having us understand them with what I suppose is a somewhat limited time frame of learning so much about a place.
Right. Well, it's always limited when you're doing a magazine piece, although the limitations at National Geographic magazine were very much more generous than what you might find in other journalistic situations. That institution has had the power to really support the writers and the photographers who go out to get these stories. My relationship with National Geographic began in 1999. They called me out of the blue one day. I had already been writing about wild places and the science of wild places for about 20 years. Then never worked for them, and they called me one day and said, "Look, we've got this big ambitious project. There's a scientist, explorer, conservationist who's going to walk 2,000 miles across the last remaining great intact forests of Central Africa, the Congo Basin, from the northeastern corner of the Republic of Congo to the Atlantic Ocean. And we're sending a photographer to document this, and we want you to go on stretches of this hike and give us three stories." So that's where it began. I worked with the photographer, great friend of mine named Nick Nichols, a great wildlife and wild places photographer. And he and I shadowed this scientist, Mike Fay is his name, legendarily tough and devoted and knowledgeable about tropical forest. We followed him step by step, not for the whole hike, but I followed him for about 53 days out of the 456 days he spent on the trail. And I wrote these three stories, and Nick photographed them, and that became sort of an iconic project for National Geographic magazine, the sort of thing that they felt they were meant to be doing even into the 21st century. And it began this 20-year stretch of me being one of the go-to guys for National Geographic magazine when it came to wild places, the efforts to conserve wild places, and scientific research to understand how wild places work. So they would send me out to, "Do you want to do the Serengeti lion with Nick?" "Sure, I do." "Do you want to do elephants in northern Kenya?" "Of course." And I would go out then, and I would read the scientific articles and talk to the scientists. And then I would tell stories of people struggling to protect nature, not just about the lions, not just about the elephants, but about the people doing their jobs on behalf of these creatures and places.
What are the challenges that you come away with of that conservation efforts?
Well, what are the challenges? Well, the big challenge is always, how do you protect non-human creatures, the plants and the animals and the fungi and the other creatures of wild ecosystems, while also taking care of the people in that situation? And there are always people. There are a few places on this planet that have never been explored or lived in by people. It becomes a problem when the people become more numerous and more technologically equipped to exploit wild nature, and then we lose wild nature. But in many of these cases, there are people still living lives close to the ground and close to nature, villagers surrounding our great national parks. And it's important not to exclude them from the picture, to exclude them from the effort. That's why I love the story about Greg Carr and Gorongosa National Park so much. That's a park that was devastated by 17 years of civil war. Greg Carr, this wealthy American, was invited to come in and sponsor the restoration of it, working with Mozambican scientists and others. And he and they remained attuned to the fact that there are 100,000 people living in a buffer zone around this park, and we want this park to be the best thing rather than the worst thing that ever happened to them. If there are elephants coming out of the park and trampling through and eating their corn crop, we want to help them with that. We want to protect that elephant, but keep her inside the park and be ready to alert them. If the mountain has been deforested, we want to help them reforest the mountain with native vegetation and plant shade-grown coffee underneath that and help them develop their coffee-growing enterprises. We want to help the young girls stay in school, in their village schools, so they don't get married off at the age of 12 or 13. Gorongosa National Park is a paradigm of what can be done under difficult situation to save the wildlife, the wildness of the ecosystem, and take care of the people around it and help them take care of themselves.
So how does that become the norm rather than the outlier?
Well, I think the only answer I can give to that is that spreading the word helps. I mean, that's why I write about these places. That's why I've collected these pieces into a book and tried to synthesize an overview of it, because I want to spread the word to other people about what can be done, the sorts of things that give hope, the sorts of things that people should support, and also an awareness of how we're all involved. I mean, most people have no direct connection, obviously, with Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique, but we all are consumers. We have 8 billion hungry humans on this planet, and we all consume food and clothing and natural resources of all sorts, fossil fuels, strategic minerals like cobalt and coltan that go into our laptops and our smartphones. We're all connected, and those minerals, coltan and cobalt, come out of wild places in the Western Congo. And the people who mine those minerals are digging in the dirt, and they're living very difficult lives. And when they need protein, there's the situation is that generally they have to rely on wildlife. So we humans who consume those things put pressure on the wildlife in those wild places. Eating those wild species also exposes people to new diseases. So it's all connected, and that's what I'm trying to help people see while telling stories that I hope are entertaining and uplifting at the same time.
The essays range from 2000 to 2020. Do you see major changes, major challenges, major problem solving that has taken place over those two decades through this reporting?
I do, and some of it is what I already mentioned. There is in the conservation community now much more awareness that you have to base your conservation efforts in local communities. You have to be sympathetic to local communities. You have to listen to them. You have to be attuned to the local human communities that surround and sometimes overlap with your wild ecosystems. For instance, I live in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Some of that is Yellowstone National Park. Some of that is National Forest, this contiguous ecosystem. And some of it is ranch lands and even little urban parks and forests and stream channels that come through the town that I live, that sometimes you have brown bears and even grizzly bears coming down into those areas. There's an overlap. You have to work with that, deal with the people's needs, legitimate needs, as well as the needs of the wild creatures. And that has caught on. There is more and more awareness of that in the conservation community. At the same time, there are trends that are more negative, including the increased acuteness and obviousness of climate change and its impacts on wild places. We've got forest fire smoke in Bozeman, Montana, right now, yesterday and today, in the month of May. Why are there forest fires burning in the province of Alberta with the winds carrying the smoke down here in May? Forest fires in May. I suspect, but I don't yet know, it's because you've got a lot of dead trees up there that have died as a result of climate change, warmer temperatures not eliminating the insect pests, such as pine beetles, that kill trees wholesale, that are killing a lot of millions of trees across the northern part of the planet. And those dead trees dry out, and so we've got forest fires in May. That's a disturbing trend, but not a trend that we should lose hope about. It's a trend that we can do things about, and I always think it's important not to indulge in despair, but to embrace the duty of hope.
I feel compelled to ask you not only about, because we can talk about climate change and nature and things that have evolved and changed over time, but life as a magazine journalist has changed too. And yes, you're working for the National Geographic, but it's a very different world than 20 years ago.
It is a very different world, and much more of it is online. It has become difficult for magazines. Some of them have adapted well. National Geographic is working to try and adapt well, but it is absolutely a different world in a lot of ways. And some of those, I'll tell you frankly, Joe, when I first worked for National Geographic to do that trek across the Congo, they said to me, all right, you're traveling internationally, you're traveling across oceans, so because you're on a feature assignment, you'll travel business class when you fly to the Congo. And you can make three trips to do these three stories. And I said to them, well, I really want to spend as much time as possible in the field with this guy hiking through these jungles. What if I make four trips instead of three and fly coach instead of business class? And they looked at me like I had two heads or something, but they said, all right, if you want to do that, fine. Today, they don't offer you business class. Lots and lots of other things have been drawn down to earth. Magazine budgets have tightened. Magazines are fighting for readers, many of whom only want to, read social media off their phones, et cetera. It is a very different world, but if grizzly bears and black-footed ferrets can adapt and survive, then it's incumbent on us to adapt and survive too.
The name of the book is The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. The book is published by National Geographic. David Quammen, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for your interest.
Be
Enjoyed
well.
Talking with you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Heartbeat of the Wild. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.